Good morning. It is Sunday, December 4th, 2011. Today, in confronting chosenness, I decided for the next, you know, some idea for the next few weeks, actually. Since in the, when we focused on the biblical side of things, we had a contrast between the types of covenants between Abraham, where God just comes down and sets Abraham up and says, you know, you're...
Do this.
Well, not do this. That was one of the things. There was nothing conditional attached to it. It's like, I'm going to make you into a great nation. And then the do this part was more... Well, Lech Lecha, yes, but there wasn't so much in terms of the actual covenant of, if you do this, then good stuff is going to happen. Mm-hmm. And we contrasted that with the Brit of Matan Torah, that there was more conditions attached to the blessings that the Jews would get. So what I wanted to do for the next 2 weeks is today focus on a few midrashim related to Avraham. Next week deal with some midrashim related to Matan Torah, because to give another dimension of, well, how did the rabbis take these particular narratives in the Bible, and then in subsequent weeks, start getting into more of the meat in terms of, well, how, what was the actual relationship between, you know, sort of the Jews and non-Jews, or Jews' views of non-Jews in the rabbinic period. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we're going to address today, in particular with Avraham Avinu, is the question of why Avraham. And this is something that the sages do kind of address. When we saw the Bible, you just look at the Torah itself, there doesn't seem to be anything unique or distinct about Avraham to merit this particular selection. Now, you're right, it says, Lech Lecha, go. You don't know if God spoke to other people and said, you know, do this, and whether or not they listened or not. No one else really, you know, enters into it. And, you know, aside from that, it doesn't, like, it's almost disproportionate to say, oh, you know, someone picked up and left because God said so, and therefore, he's entitled to a brit olam, some permanent covenant that cannot be abrogated, no matter how hard his descendants have tried in subsequent generations. So even though that's a very unique characteristic to Avraham, the sages have in various midrashim sort of elaborate on this relationship between God and Avraham that seem to make it, on one hand, a little less unique, in that there was actually more of a give and take, such that Avraham demonstrated his merit. And the reason, and that's on one hand, because you're sort of diminishing, you know, what seems to be a very unique quality of Avraham, but at the same time, you are presenting Avraham's being chosen in a way that appears to be a little more just, in that, or a little, if not more just, less arbitrary. Mm-hmm. And trying now, for any of these midrashim, you could argue with anything else with the Torah, how much do you have to take these as actual historical fact, that this in fact did happen. And again, there's really no way to know for absolute certainty. But in terms of the message for what is the point of these midrashim, well, you could argue that part of the intent could very well be to take it out of that realm of, you know, God just randomly choosing Avraham to saying, no, there was actually a particular reason for it. All right, so let's start off here with a few sources dealing with Avraham's merit. So starts off this. This is a Gemara in Nedarim 32a.
Rabbi Ami ben Abba also said, Abraham was 3 years old when he acknowledged the Creator. For it is written, because that Abraham obeyed my voice, the numerical value of H...
What's it called? Hebrew of Akev, Akev Shirti Shema, Choshana Me Avishimim Tartain. More of a footnote there. But the numerical value comes out to be 172 for Akev. If you take the word Ekev Asher Shema, Kuf is 100, Ayin is 70, and Bet is 2. So following the Gematria, comes out that he lived for 175 years, and if, based on this word Ekev, that he was 170, that for 172 years he obeyed God's voice, that means he first acknowledged God when he was 3 years old.
Mm.
That's how it does the math. Now, again, whether or not, you know, this is historically accurate based on a gematria is kind of irrelevant. What is important is that there's one opinion, Rav Ami Bar Abba, who says that Avram actually recognized God at an incredibly young age, which shows a spectacular uniqueness to Avram. Breishit Rabbah 39.1, apologize for, you know, possibly cheating by going to the Breishit Rabbah source, but important enough for rabbinic traditions nonetheless for the, our purposes. So on the Pasuk, Lech Lecha Me'artzecha, on Go from Your Land, Rabbi Isaac commenced his discourse with, Hearken, O daughter, and consider and incline thine ear. Forget also thine own people and thy father's house. Said Rabbi Isaac, this may be compared to a man who is traveling from place to place when he saw a building in flames. Is it possible that the building lacks a person to look after it, he wondered. The owner of the building looked down and said, I am the owner of the building. Similarly, because Abraham, our father, said, is it conceivable that the world is without a guide? The Holy One, blessed be He, looked out and said to him, I am the guide, sovereign of the universe. So shall the king desire beauty, i.e. to make thee glorious in the world, for he is the Lord. Do homage unto him. Hence, the Lord said to Abraham, get the Yomar Shem Lavram, get li lech lecha. So here, the implication is, Abraham came to the realization that God was God, or at least, you know, that there was, you know, had some sort of seeking in terms of who's actually running the world. And because God put in that effort to say, is it possible that this world has no manhig, that there is, or no creator, that there is no director or guide to the world. So because of that realization, God then appeared to him. Interesting contrast here. Now, on one hand, you can say that this is a sign of Avram's merit was because he sought out God. But on the other hand, if you had pagan cultures at the time, people who worshipped other gods or other idols, they could have effectively came to the same
conclusion,
or, you know, asked the same question and came to a different conclusion, saying, well, could it be that there is no, you know, guide to the world? It's like, sure, there's this god does this, this god does that, this god does that. And there's probably, you know, I think that's more reflective of the time in which Breishit Rabbah was written than really having an anachronism to what was going on at the time of Avraham. And if anything, it could be a sense of not talking about Avraham per se, but rather to a different audience, and trying to give a possible logical argument for the existence of God and using Avraham's words for that. This isn't unlike what's called the watchmaker argument, where if someone's in a desert and you find a watch in the desert, do you assume that it just came out of there, just grew out of the ground? Like, no, you assume that there was some watchmaker that put it together and somehow it wound up there. And they established what's called a kal v'chomer. Well, if a watch, that's how your approach is the watch, that there was some entity that had to create the watch. Therefore, you look at the world, which is infinitely more complex than a watch. Therefore, there must be a creator. It is an argument that's used. It is not convincing to everyone, but it's somewhat akin, you know, it finds sort of an antecedent in this midrash of just asking, could it possibly be that something so, that if in a human analogy would assume that there's someone watching, could it be that something that is so vast beyond human comprehension doesn't? An approach.
Mm-hmm.
Take Breishit Rabbah, this is 38:13.
And Haran died in the presence of his father Terach. Rabbi Hia said, Terach was a manufacturer of idols. He once went away somewhere and left Abraham to sell them in his place. A man came in and wished to buy one. How old are you, Abraham asked him. 50 years was the reply. Woe to such a man, he exclaimed. You are 50 years old and will worship a day-old object? At this, he became ashamed and departed. On another occasion, a woman came in with a plate full of flour and requested him, take this and offer it to them. So he took a stick, broke them, and put a stick in the hand of the largest. When his father returned, he demanded, what have you done to them? I cannot conceal it from you, he rejoined. A woman came with a plate full of fine meal and requested me to offer it to them. One claimed, I must eat first, while another claimed, I must eat first. Thereupon the largest arose, took the stick, and broke them. Why do you make sport of me? He cried out. Have you then any knowledge? Have they then any knowledge? Should not your ears listen to what your mouth is saying? He retorted. Thereupon he seized him and delivered him to Nimrod. Let us worship the fire, he, Nimrod, proposed. Let us rather worship water, which extinguishes the fire, replied he. Then let us worship water. Let us rather worship the clouds, which bear the water. Then let us worship the clouds. Let us rather worship the winds that disperse the clouds. Then let us worship the wind. Then let us rather worship human beings who withstand the wind. You were just bandying words, he exclaimed. We will worship naught but the fire. Behold, I will cast you into it and let your God, whom you adore, come and save you from it. Now Haran was standing there undecided. If Abraham is victorious, thought he, I will say that I am of Abraham's belief. While if Nimrod is victorious, I will say that I'm on Nimrod's side. When Abraham descended into the fiery furnace and was saved, he, Nimrod, asked him, of whose belief are you? Of Abraham's, he replied. Thereupon he seized and cast him into the fire. His inwards were scorched, and he died in his father's presence. Hence it is written, and Haran died in the presence of all his father,
Terah. So you have a narrative here that's taught about Abraham, and in some ways Terah too. The two halves of this, the first part is dialogue where he pretends like, oh, you know, the statues got into a fight with each other, and he says, oh, that's impossible, and basically saying, well, you know, shows that why are you praying down to these, you know, stone idols? It's like, clearly, you know, if you're acknowledging that they can actually do stuff, why are they objects of worship?
Mm-hmm.
And the second part, he has an argument with Nimrod and saying, well, you want to worship this, there's always going to be something more powerful, so why are you worshiping that? In, you know, if you want to take this purely as a matter of Avraham Avinu in his life, it puts in another context, not just God, you know, Avraham recognizing God, but also recognizing specifically monotheism, or a contrast to paganism, or the paganism that was around him. You could argue, like, if you view it again factually, that this gives you a little more insight into what Avraham's mode of thinking was that would make him righteous enough or unique enough for God to seek out such a person who's willing to stand up for the beliefs of monotheism in the face of, you know, clear persecution. You could also see this as a bit of an anachronism of someone trying to explain in later days where, you know, idolatry, you know, could still be somewhat prominent, and, you know, the arguments for monotheism maybe not as great. This could very well be, you know, Rabbi Chiya giving his own polemic, but using the words, you know, putting, you know, his words in the mouth of Avraham. Mm-hmm. Because the logic is still essentially the same. Why are you praying down to statues when you know that you just created this statue? You know that this statue has absolutely no power, and yet you pray to it. Or people would seek out other elements of nature, which are not uncommon in, you know, pagan religions, saying, well, everything is more powerful than something else. And by attributing such ideas to Avraham, you know, also helps give it a greater weight too. And I mention this because it's a bit of a contrast of when you look at such midrashim, you can look at these in multiple ways. You could either look at such things at face value and say, oh, this is what we know about Avraham Avinu. Possibly. I mean, that could be a possible intent, but it's also possible to say that you have later rabbinic ideas that are being expressed through biblical characters, because there's no evidence of most of this in the actual text of the Bible at all.
Right.
There does seem to be a bit of a tradition regarding Avraham and Nimrod that isn't unique. There's a Gemara in Pesachim 118a that says, when the wicked Nimrod cast the father Abraham into the fiery furnace, Gabriel said to the Holy One, blessed be he, sovereign of the universe, let me go down and cool it and deliver that righteous man from the fiery furnace. Said the Holy One, blessed be he, to him, I am unique in my world, and he is unique in his world. For it is fitting for him who is unique to deliver him who is unique. Because the Holy One, blessed be he, does not withhold reward from any creature. He said to him, thou shalt be privileged to deliver three of his descendants. Meaning that be able to... one second, underline that there. Now the operative, you know, words here in the Hebrew are the yachid, v'hu yachid ba'olamo. This, right, meaning beyond, you know, you have one a distinction about, you know, an elaboration of the story with Nimrod, but it emphasizes the fact that Abraham, however, you know, whatever he thought, did in fact make him unique in the world. Not just that he thought, you know, matters of theology, but that he thought matters of theology and came to a conclusion ostensibly of monotheism. And thus, because of his uniqueness, I mean, the story here happened before he was told Lech Lecha by God chronologically. So if you want to place this in, you know, Abraham's lifetime, first, Abraham, you know, makes these decisions and he goes first, and then God comes and says Lech Lecha and then makes all the deals with him, which puts the whole narrative, now again, this is almost, I mean, I use a term in comics called a retcon, retroactive continuity, where you have later sources that, oh, you know, we're going to reinterpret what happened in a previous narrative, and that informs something that was later. So if you view this and sort of read these stories back into the Torah, then it wasn't God just picking Abraham out of the blue. It was because he was a prodigy at, you know, the age of three. And, you know, yes,
he merited all that stuff.
Exactly. He merited all that stuff, not just because he was particularly righteous for stuff that he did, but he was the most, you know, theologically advanced, you know, by Judaism standards, of anyone else in the world.
Mm-hmm. Well, I just wanted to throw in this. Someone who comes up with the theory of monotheism or considers it to be the way things work, not necessarily such a meritorious concept. You got Aristotle, who had the idea that the universe was always in existence and it never got created, and it didn't need a creator. So, you know, that's also a viable way to look at things, and I don't know that we have to pin a medal on the guy who comes up with the theory of monotheism, who considers the universe something that had to be created.
So the way that the sages would say is not that Aram invented monotheism. It would not be the way to put it, because, you know, assuming, like, it's an operative assumption that the world is run by God and a one singular God, then that is the way the world works, independent of what people think of it. Mm-hmm. You could also argue, you know, the same thing with paganism, that if in fact there are many gods running the world, someone doesn't come up and invent paganism. Like, the world is the way the world is. These aren't things that one discovers as much as ideas that someone might have come up with. Okay? Now, in the Jewish system, you know, at least in the description of Abram here, wasn't that Abram, you know, was the first to discover God, and God interacted with, say, Adam HaRishon, God interacted with Noah. But the fact that after, you know, 10 generations, you know, for whatever thing, it was lost, or following Rambam's explanation of the development of religions, you know, people started, instead of worshiping God, started worshiping agents of God, like the sun and the moon and the stars, and, you know, sort of branched out. And then Abraham, you know, 10 generations later realized, hey, wait a second, you know, this doesn't make sense for a whole lot of reasons, and sort of recovered maybe lost knowledge. But it wasn't something that Abraham would have invented. That would be like saying, you know, Abraham invented the single God, which, you know, in the Jewish scheme of things, just really doesn't make sense. But it does show that despite everything else that was going on, Abram reached this conclusion on his own. Also interesting that he did it, or at least as described by Chazal, based on reason. And based on the reason, you know, relative to everyone else around him. Which I think does have certain implications of, you know, especially if you are, you know, if you want to attribute some of these midrashim to post, you know, Greco-Roman culture that did have numerous statues and gods, then it does serve as a very interesting foil to a lot of the other, you know, pagan and idol worship.
Just check, see if my
Okay. But moving along, I mean, there are other things about Avraham Avinu that aren't entirely positive. There's a Gemara in Nedarim, also Rebbe Abahu said in Rebbe Elazar's name. In fact, the Gemara in Nedarim has a lot of Midrashim related to Avraham. I only picked out a couple. Why was our father Abraham punished and his children doomed to Egyptian servitude for 210 years? So one option, because he pressed scholars into his service. As it is written, he armed his dedicated service born in his own house. Samuel said, because he went too far in testing the attributes, the promises of the Lord. As it is written, Lord God, whereby shall I know I shall inherit it? Rav Yochanan, I don't know why it says san. These are just copied and pasted from the Sincino, but it most likely means said. Because he prevented men from entering beneath the wings of the Shekhinah, as it is written, and the king of Sodom said to Abraham, give me persons and take thy goods to yourself. There was a certain understanding that Avraham, despite being chosen by God for being particularly unique, didn't do everything 100% perfectly. I think we also discussed here in another context, that was a drush about one midrash in Shemot Rabbah critiques Avraham for not being a great father, in particular to Ishmael.
Isn't he the guy that went to Sarah? No, Sarah was with. Yeah, he said, "Say you're my sister, not not my wife." And she could have had sex with other men. And somebody said to him, "Look, you almost had a sin. Why did you tell us?" So that's a pretty creepy aspect of...
He doesn't actually get criticized for it. I mean, just to go off on a brief tangent with that, his concern was that they would kill him and take Sarah for a wife. Now, the very fact that right when he crosses over, she gets taken, kind of proves his concerns correct. So, anyway, another Gemara Nedarim 32a.
Did I turn the page on?
You were on page 3. Source number 6.
Okay. Rav Judah said, it said Sandy, you screwed up on
that. This is me copying and pasting from the Sincino. For some reason, all the sans are seds are written as sans.
Judah said in Rav's name, when the Holy One, blessed be He, said to our father Abraham, walk before me and be thou perfect, he was seized with trembling. Perhaps he said, there is still aught shameful in me. But when he added, and I will make my covenant between me and thee, his mind was appeased. And.
Yeah, so for some reason the N's and I's are swapped. Yeah. Anyway.
He brought him forward abroad. Now Abraham had said unto him, Sovereign of the universe, I have gazed at the constellation which rules my destiny, and seen that I am not fated to beget children. To which God replied, go forth from thy astrological speculations. Israel is not subject to planetary influences.
So in this Gemara, and there are two things I wanted to bring out here. One, in this one of the dialogues that according to Rav, Avram had with God, he offers, Yesh bi davar meguneh, maybe there's something wrong with me. And the response is that Nebriti Venu Venecha, like I'm going to actually make a covenant with you, his mind was appeased. God's response, according to Rav here, isn't that you were perfect, but rather, we're going to actually make a covenant. And that there's it's not just Hitalech Lefanai V'yehatamim, like, I don't expect perfection from you, right? Which seemed to be the way it was, you could take it. It's like, no, wait a second. Maybe there's something going to be wrong. There's an understanding that whatever Avraham might have merited, it wasn't, the Brit might have been actually for his benefit, such that, in fact, if he does mess up, because, people are human, he has some, protection and some sort of coverage. It gives a very different idea to what this idea of the Brit is. And finally, he adds here of, this line of Ein Mazal Yisrael, that you are no longer subject to planetary influences, which is actually a matter of dispute in the Talmud. Also interesting that this particular statement shows that degree of anachronism, because at this point Yisrael didn't really exist. Yaakov Yisrael was his, grandchild. So there's clearly certain things like that, you know, they're sort of retrofitting into some of the narratives here. But, you know, in terms of the uniqueness and the merit of Avram, these sources do give us a different dimension and sort of color in a lot more than just Avram was randomly chosen by God. There's a lot more here about Avram deserving it, a little bit more in terms of the exchange that might make things make a little more sense or a little less arbitrary to someone who would just pick up the Bible and rely on that. I wanted to include two more sources here dealing with the relationship between specifically Avraham and other non-Jews. And we'll see what I mean in a second. One is Gemara in Brachot, based on a pasuk in Divrei Hayamim of Avram hu Avraham, that Avram is, you know, that very short pasuk, Avram, his initial name is Avraham. Gemara says, B'tchila nasa av la'aram. First, he was a father to Aram, name of the place, hence Avram. It's, you know, somewhat of a pun there, only, right? But in the end, he became father to the whole world. Uvelesof na'ase av, he was a father, l'chol ha'olam kulo, to the entire world. And a similar derash is made about Sarah, where Sarai hi Sarah, b'tchila na'asit Sarai la'amuta, that at first she was a princess to her own people, v'lesof na'asit Sarah l'chol alam kulo, and then she became a princess to the entire world. This source alone would seem to indicate that a universality to Avraham and Sarah. And if you view the world as just a matter of, well, you know, from the Abrahamic traditions, you've got three of, you know, the world's major religions of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. You know, you wouldn't be incorrect. You know, is that what's the intent here? I'm not so sure, but it does bestow a certain universality to Abraham and Sarah that you wouldn't necessarily have expected. In contrast, a Gemara Nedarim 31a has, you know, somewhat of a quick give and take of a line in a Mishnah followed by a very quick Talmudic extrapolation. Mishnah says, "Konem that if you take a vow, she'eni nehaneh lifnei Noach, that I don't benefit from the children of Noach, mutar b'Yisrael va'asur ba'odei kochavim, you may benefit from Israelites, but not from non-Jews, or not from non-Jews, but specifically idol worshippers, heathens." The Gemara asks, "V'Yisrael minafik michlal b'nei Noach, but aren't Jews also descendants of Noach?" Meaning at some point, because, you know, God wiped out the whole world in the flood, Jews are as much technically children of Noah as non-Jews, because Abraham came from Noah. It's, you know, you can set up a little Venn diagram, so to speak, right, where, you know, we would still be included in that. And the Gemara answers, Kevan de'it kadesh Avraham itkaru al shemeh, that since Abraham was sanctified, they are called by his name. Meaning, once you have the Abraham, you know, makes the, makes his arrangement, has that rite with God, we're sort of taken out of that category of B'nai Noah. Whereas in the previous source, there was a sense of exclusivity of Avram, you know, being, you know, for the whole world. Now we have Avram in contrast as distinct from anyone else. Mm-hmm. In the next Mishnah, say, well, let's say Konam, or Konam, I should say, a vow that you do not benefit from the seed of Avraham. It is forbidden to benefit from the Israelites, but permitted to benefit from the heathens. Okay, seems to be the exact opposite. V'ha ika Yishmael. So what do you do with the descendants of Ishmael? So according, you know, later verse, Kivi Yitzchak Yekarei Lachazara, since the verse later states that only through the children of Isaac you will have your seed called, Yekarei Lachazarektiv. So because the descendants were supposed to go from Isaac, that once you say the descendants of Abraham, according to this Gemara, the other descendants, even of Abraham alone, don't count as his descendants. At least for the purposes of vows, which again negates the universal, not just the Ishmaelites, but it negates the universalism that we saw in Brachot 13. Then it goes one step further. V'ha'ika Esav. But what about Esau? Because if you want to say Yitzchak Yikarei Lecha Zarah, that the descendants specifically of Isaac, well, Esau came out of Isaac just as much as Yisrael, you know, as Yaakov.
Mm-hmm.
And the answer is given, Bi Yitzchak Velo Ko Yitzchak. And the answer is, it means through Isaac, but not all of Isaac. Meaning just, like, all it means is the seed just has to go through this particular source, but it is by no means every possible avenue. And I really like this contrast here, because on one hand you have Abraham, you know, Abraham is, you know, set up as, you know, in just from Brachot, something that's universal, and here you have that descendants and that lineage becoming narrower and narrower, even if it is semantically and historically true based on the Bible. There are important distinctions for the purposes of Al, such that if you say, well, B'nai Noach, well, even though technically you are B'nai Noach, you don't count because Avram set it aside. B'nai Avram, well, that's only, you know, specifically through Yitzchak, but not through Yishmael. And they say, oh, but what about Yitzchak? What about Esau? I'm like, no, even, you know, Esau still doesn't count. And I think this helps show, you know, even through the Abrahamic tradition, so to speak, you know, be it for whatever reasons of his initial chosenness, but here you have, you know, the beginnings, or you should, for this class's purposes, of Abraham being unique and being exclusive compared to the rest of the world, even if technically there may be more of a biological kinship. And we see how this plays out, at least in one particular halacha. All right? And anyone is interested, this Tuesday we will be dealing with various forms of rabbinic fallibility in our Fundamentals of Judaism class, and next week in Confronting Chosenness we'll be discussing certain midrashim in different dimensions about the brit, the covenants, at Har Sinai. Have a good week. Be well.